This evening, I'd like for you to imagine that you own a business. And your business is that you are a building contractor. You do different kinds of work, but you specialize in renovations, do all kinds of areas of renovation, building new walls or rooms, or redoing the heating and cooling system. And you are contacted by another member of the church. You yourself are a member of the church. And there's a deal struck, a contract struck, in which you are going to do several thousand dollars of work, of renovation work, to this particular member's house. And the work proceeds as the contract suggests. And you finish the work and you go to the client and you say, well, what do you think? It's time for you to pay me. And the other member of the church says, I'm dissatisfied with what's been done. I don't like the way you did it. I'm not paying. What do you do? That's not a hypothetical question. That is an actual situation that I learned about, in which one member of the church refused to pay another member of the church for a large project that had been completed as was specified. And he went out of business. He lost his business because he couldn't eat the cost of all of the materials that had gone into this renovation project and the labor that he had expended over a period of time in order to do this particular project. How would you have responded in that particular case? Well, this evening we're going to be talking about some things that relate to that, a couple of questions in our question and answer sermon. Most of you, I think, are quite familiar with the format. For those who may be visiting this evening and not be familiar with it, I take questions from various sources, from members and from others, and I'll answer them. They are not necessarily related to one another. We'll deal with one question and answer it and go on to the next question. We rarely get beyond two, despite my good intentions at times. And we're trying to make practical application of the scriptures to various things that we face in life. But we want the questions to be practical. This evening's questions are, first of all, one that deals with the Christian and self-defense. Can a Christian defend himself against a violent attacker? And then, of course, as you would guess, the second question has to do with, as we've already suggested, lawsuits between brethren. Is it okay under some circumstance for one brother to take another brother to law in the civil courts? Now, as I've explained on a number of occasions, when the question is in quotes, that means that's exactly how I received the question. This first question was as follows: can a Christian physically defend himself or someone else from the attack of a violent aggressor, such as a robber or rapist? I asked Tim to read from Matthew, the 5th chapter, because this question really stems mostly from a comment that Jesus makes, several of them actually, in the latter part of chapter 5. And so if you'll look at the passage, the portion of the passage that Tim read that's up on the screen, Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person. And it is that phrase, that sentence, I should say, in verse 39, that suggests to some people that it is wrong for a Christian to resist even one who would come into your home, break into your home, and perhaps with the intention of harming your family or harming you. And because of what Jesus says here in verse 39, the Christian is not permitted even to defend himself or his family. So we need to ask some questions about that. Is that what Jesus is trying to say here? Is he speaking in absolute terms? Can we not resist an evil person under any circumstances? Is it wrong for a Christian to defend himself from the attack of a violent aggressor? Or do we understand this passage to be teaching the willingness to accept wrong in certain circumstances? Well, one of the things that we need to remember as we answer any of the questions that are submitted is that all truth that's equally related to the same subject needs to harmonize. I understand there are some things said in the Old Law that we wouldn't necessarily harmonize with statements in the New Testament. They're on different subjects. They were made with respect to two different covenants. But when we're talking about the same covenant, when we're talking about the same subject, truth needs to harmonize. And so whatever understanding or interpretation that we place on a particular passage or sentence or comment, it needs to harmonize with what else the Scriptures say about that same subject. That's a basic principle of Bible interpretation, as I think probably all of you are aware. And so I'm going to suggest to you that this passage, Matthew 5, verses 38 through 42, is in fact qualified by other passages. Are there any examples in the Scriptures of God's people resisting an evil person? Because if we can find such an example, an approved example of where a Christian or a disciple resisted an evil person, then we know that there must be some qualification to the statement that Jesus made in Matthew 5 and verse 39. Well, I'm going to suggest several statements that I think qualify, and I'll suggest to you that they qualify to varying degrees. Jesus rebuked in his trial, the Jewish side of his trial, the officer who struck him. And for the sake of clarity, I'd like to read some of these passages. They're not going to be up on the screen. If you've got your New Testaments, turn to John the 18th chapter and notice that in the context of Jesus being questioned by the high priest, in verse 22 of John 18, Jesus has just responded that he'd already been teaching him publicly and people knew what he taught. And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" Jesus answered him. Now listen carefully to what Jesus says. "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" What Jesus says here is a rebuke of what this officer had done. What the officer had done was wrong. It was unlawful. And Jesus rebukes him, and so at least in that sense, there's some resistance to the evil person. Paul does a similar thing, although in Acts chapter 23, verses 1 through 3, the high priest commands Paul to be struck. And once again, let's very quickly take a look at this passage. You may recall that the apostle Paul is in front of the Council in chapter 23 and verse 1, he makes this statement, "Men and brethren, I've lived in all good conscience before God unto this day." Now we look at that and think, Paul was a persecutor when he was Saul of Tarsus. How could he make that statement that he lived in good conscience? I'm not sure that's what bothered the high priest. I think the high priest was probably more bothered by the fact that Paul was going out and preaching salvation to Gentiles on the same basis as Jews. But at any rate, in verse 2, it says, "And the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him," now listen to the words of Paul, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?" So Jesus says, what you have just commanded is against the law. Do you command me to be struck against the law while you pretend to judge me by the law? Is that not a rebuke of what's going on here in Acts chapter 23? I think clearly it is. In Acts the 13th chapter, near the very beginning of Paul's first missionary journey with Barnabas, his companion, Paul struck a man by the name of Elymas, a sorcerer, an advisor, if you will, of Sergius Paulus, the proconsul there in Cyprus. He struck him with blindness. Elymas was opposing Paul and making it difficult for Paul to have influence with the proconsul. And so Paul strikes Elymas with blindness, calls him a son of the devil. My point is that in each of these cases, there is some rebuke, there's some resistance to the evil that's being expressed by these individuals. But you know, Paul used Roman law to protect himself on more than one occasion. If you may recall, in Acts the 22nd chapter, verses 23 through 29, at the conclusion of Paul's third missionary journey, he's in Jerusalem. He's actually gone into the temple to assist with the completion of some vows of some Jewish individuals, and a mob scene erupts. He is accused on the fly of bringing Gentiles into a forbidden area in the temple, and the mob there is determined to beat him to death. The Roman soldiers come out of the fortress Antonia, which had steps that led right down into the courtyard, and they rescue Paul. You may recall that in chapter 22, he's addressing these Jews who had just moments before been beating him to death, and he's now reasoning with them. That's to no avail. The soldiers have to rescue Paul and carry him into the fortress. And the Roman centurion there decides that the way he's going to find out what's going on is he's going to have Paul beaten, scourged. Now that may seem rather unfair to us, but the fact of the matter is, under Roman law, if you are not a Roman citizen, a Roman with authority could snatch you off the street and beat you senseless, and it wasn't against the law. In fact, that was the way that you got the truth out of people, is that you beat them, and that's what they were apparently going to do with Paul. But now, as they bound him, preparing to scourge him, in Acts chapter 22 and verse 25, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" Now we know Paul was a Roman citizen, as he relates here, and it was illegal to beat a Roman citizen who was uncondemned. And so the centurion, when he heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, "Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman." I believe I said the centurion later earlier. Commander was who I should have said. Then the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" Paul answers, "Yes." The commander answered, "With a large sum I obtained the citizenship." That was kind of a clandestine way to become a Roman citizen. You bought your citizenship. But Paul says, "I was born a citizen." And so Paul protected himself from being scourged, which was a rather violent form of beating on this occasion, by appealing to the law of the land. He resisted evil on this occasion. There's another occasion over in chapter 25, after there's been a change of governors. Felix has left the governorship and he's been replaced by Festus. And the Jews are working with Festus, trying to get Festus to turn Paul over so that they over to them, or release him so that they can take their revenge against Paul. But when Paul realizes that Festus is perhaps thinking about doing that, he says in verse 10 of Acts 25, "I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I'm an offender, I've committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there's nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar." That was the right of a Roman citizen. Paul is availing himself of a privilege that was his because he was a Roman citizen, that he could appeal his case even to the highest court, that is to the emperor himself. In this case, Paul may have saved himself from death, in light of what the Jewish plans were for him. And so what we have is some instances, clear instances, of where evil is opposed and individuals protected themselves against evil, particularly Paul here in the last two examples. In fact, we're told to resist the devil. Now back in Matthew chapter 5, verse 39, Jesus says, "Do not resist an evil person." But there's no one who epitomizes evil more than Satan himself. He's a liar and a murderer from the beginning. And we are specifically told by James in James chapter 4 and verse 7, and also by Peter in 1 Peter 5 and verse 9, to resist him steadfast in the faith. So we can resist Satan, but we can't resist those who are his ministers, who are carrying out his purposes. I find that hard to believe. But I want to show you another example of where evil was resisted. In John the second chapter, in the near the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, John records that Jesus, while in Jerusalem, found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. Most of us are familiar with what was going on there. If you were a pilgrim coming from another place to one of the Jewish feasts, and Or even for that matter, just in the land of Palestine someplace, and you'd want to carry an animal with you, you would come to the temple and you could buy an animal right there in the courtyard that had already been certified by the priest as acceptable for a sacrifice. And so they were doing business right there in the temple. There's implications from some of the comments of Jesus that not everything that was being done was really fair. That they had become, that they'd made the house of the Lord a den of thieves. There were money changers there also, set up their tables. And you, when you came to pay the temple tax, which every Jewish male had to pay annually, you had to pay that tax in the shekel, the Jewish shekel of the temple. You had to change money from other currencies, Roman currencies, or wherever you came from. And these money changers, well, in our culture, bankers don't have a really good reputation right now. Those from Wall Street, these people were probably also charging high interest to make that change. And so Jesus comes into the temple. He sees these who are selling oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers. And he makes a whip of cords and he drove them all out of the temple. Now look, with the sheep and the oxen, who is he driving in the second verse there? He's driving the people who were selling the animals. He's driving the money changers. He poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. Is Jesus resisting evil here? Absolutely. And frankly, he's doing it in a physical way. I used to argue that what probably... I should back up a little bit. How many of you saw the musical Jesus Christ Superstar? Man, I am dating myself. Way back in the old ages, that was a rather popular musical when it came out. Oh, there was a... It was a member at the congregation I was working with at the time. I don't even remember who it was. And he had seen this thing, and he just thought it was the best thing. And he hounded me until I finally agreed to watch it. And one of the most interesting scenes in it, it wasn't all that great a musical, but anyway, one of the interesting scenes was when Jesus cleanses the temple. Jesus is jumping around and carrying on like a madman in the musical. He's thrashing people and throwing things around and everything. And at the time I looked at that and I thought, that's just bizarre. Because that's not the stately, gentle, peaceful, shepherd-like Savior that I had pictured. And I would explain this passage by saying that, well, Jesus probably just drove out the animals. But you read that carefully, and I don't think you can come to that conclusion. Jesus made a whip of cords. He drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. He was driving somebody else in addition to the animals. Now, did Jesus lose his temple? Did he temper? Did he lose his temple? Did he lose his temper, fly off the handle, and sin here? Well, obviously not. But he forced these individuals to leave the temple courtyard and to stop doing what they were doing that was wrong. That's an example of someone resisting an evil person. That's the example of the Lord. And you know what? He did it twice. John talks about it near the beginning of Jesus' ministry. The synoptic gospels record that Jesus apparently did much the same thing at the end of his public ministry. Some commentators believe those are the same stories. They've just been put in different places by the gospel writers. I don't believe that's the case. I believe it happened twice. And it, again, he went into the temple of God, drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple. Did any of them decide they didn't want to go? You know, they thought they belonged there. They were allowed to do this business in the temple courtyard by the high priest, which is why in this second case, the Jews will come to Jesus, if I recall correctly, on the next day and say, "By what authority do you do these things? You're upsetting the apple cart. Who said you could do this?" Those people thought they could do that. They'd been authorized to do that. Do you think they wanted to stay there? Jesus drove them out. Overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, "It's written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer.' You've made it a den of thieves." Jesus resisted evil, and he did it in a physical way. I think that seems to be pretty clear from those passages. Well, we've already talked some about resisting evil, at least within the context of maybe preaching the gospel or in the service of Christ. But what about self-defense? If somebody breaks into your home and they're threatening you or your family with violence, or perhaps it's already starting, can you defend yourself? Can you protect others, whether it's your family in your own home, or whether you are have the opportunity to protect somebody in some other venue or setting? You know something I find interesting? We humans also have a survival instinct, just like the animals do. Animals will fight to survive, and so will we under most circumstances. Humans will go to all kinds of lengths to preserve their lives. Where did that come from? Who put that instinct in you? I believe God did. I believe God's the source of that instinct. But I know that Jesus, when he instructed his 12 disciples as he sent them out to preach in the cities of Israel, he said, if you're being persecuted in one city, what do? You flee to another city. They were allowed to protect themselves in that way, to flee from what persecution was taking place to another location where they could be safe from persecution. I'm going to put up a quotation from Martin Luther. It was apparently one of his table talks, and it doesn't prove anything. But I find it interesting the reasoning that Martin Luther used for his view of whether or not he could defend himself against another who wished to do him violence. He writes, or he said, if anyone breaks into my home, tries to do violence to my family or to myself or to cause harm, I am bound to defend myself. He didn't say I have a right. He said I'm bound to defend myself and them in my capacity as master of the house and a head of the family. If brigands or murderers have tried to harm me or do me wrongful violence, I should have defended myself and resisted them in the name of the prince whose subject I am. I don't believe that he's talking about Jesus there. I think he's talking about a secular ruler. I may be wrong about that, but I'm not. I must help the prince to purge his country of bad subjects. And if I have the strength to cut this bandit's throat, it's my duty to take the knife to him. But if I'm attacked on account of the divine word, now listen to this. But if I'm attacked on account of the divine word in my capacity as a preacher, then I must endure it and leave God to punish him and avenge me. That's an interesting viewpoint. He doesn't say I have the right to defend myself. He says I have the obligation to defend my family as master of my house and head of my family. Now, there'll be times, he says, when I may not be able to do that. It may be that the persecution's coming because of my faith in Christ. Now, again, Martin Luther's not inspired. Martin Luther's a respected Bible scholar, but he's not inspired. He didn't prove anything, but I think that's an interesting viewpoint that ought to be considered. Well, let's go back to Matthew 5 and verse 39. Let's go back and look at the greater context of the statement that we have been alluding to here a number of times. Matthew 5 and verse 39, where Jesus says, "But I tell you not to resist an evil person." Is there any reason in the greater context, in the verses that surround Matthew 5:39, is there any reason to believe that we might not need to take Jesus' statements here in an absolute sense? Remember, I asked that question in the very beginning. Should we understand Jesus' statement, you're not to resist an evil person, to be an absolute statement that you can't resist an evil person under any circumstance? And what we've done is we've looked at other passages that suggest that's not the case, that this passage needs to be qualified by what's approved in other places, both the example of Jesus and the example of Paul. But now I want to look at this section as a whole. I want to back up, in fact, to verse 34, where Jesus says, "Do not swear at all." Now that's a pretty straightforward statement. Do not swear at all. In fact, let's just read beginning in verse 33, where Jesus says, "Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all." There's the statement. "Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one." Now, if we were to not look at any other passage, if we were to just consider that passage without trying to harmonize it with what else the Scriptures reveal to us, it might seem at first glance that you can't swear at all. You couldn't take a judicial oath, that is a witness, to tell the truth or all the truth. You couldn't swear in any sense to confirm or affirm your word. Now, I do believe that the point Jesus is making here is that you oughtn't have to do that. Your yes ought to be yes, your no ought to be no, and you don't need an oath to confirm the fact that you're telling the truth. But I want to show you something. God swore. He used oaths. Number of occasions. Peter even refers to that in Acts, the second chapter. I think it's worth our while to take a look at this. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 30, in the midst of Peter the Apostle's sermon here on the day of Pentecost, Peter has cited the prophecy of David from Psalm 16, back in verses 25 through 28. Now, here's what he says in verse 29 and 30. Men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he's both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet and knowing, this is David knowing, that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne. He foreseeing this, David foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of the Christ. My point is that David understood that God had sworn with an oath that he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne. God swore with an oath. Same thing in Hebrews 6 and verse 17. When God wanted to confirm the certainty of Jesus being a high priest, the certainty of his promise, he confirmed it with an oath. And because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. That's the argument of the Hebrew writer. And I find it interesting that Paul used oaths, or at least language that is essentially the form of an oath, in all kinds of places in his writing. And let's take a look at a few of these. You understand, of course, that when we talk about an oath, we're not talking about swearing in the sense of using profane language. Sometimes that's the way people talk about it. We're talking about someone saying, for instance, I'm calling to witness my grandmother that I am telling the truth in this matter. And your respect for my grandmother, your respect or your consciousness of my respect for my grandmother is a means of confirming my word, that I'm telling you the truth. And so we call some other party or something else to witness that what I'm saying is the truth. Now, listen to what Paul writes to the Romans in chapter 1 and verse 9. He says, "For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of His Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers." God is my witness, he says, he writes, that I pray about you, Romans. Now, take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 1. And verse 23. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 23. The Corinthians apparently were being critical of Paul because he had changed his travel plans. It appears that some of them were at least making the charge that he was fickle, he couldn't count on Paul to keep his word, etc. And so here's what he says. He says in verse 23, "Moreover, I call God as witness against my soul that to spare you I came no more to Corinth." Paul says, "I want you to know I didn't come to Corinth because I wanted to spare you, and God is my witness." Now, that's the language of an oath. Paul used oaths in his writing. I think the point's sufficiently clear. I'm not going to go ahead and belabor it by reading these other passages. And incidentally, we could find lots more. Now, here's the question. If Jesus was teaching that we can't make an oath under any circumstance, you can't swear at all, then tell me what Paul was doing. Isn't what he's doing wrong? Or do we need to conclude that if Paul is right in what he wrote in his practice, that the statement that Jesus made there in Matthew 5 and verse 34 really isn't intended to be an absolute? It needs to be understood in the context of telling the truth or not being deceptive, of being honest and not needing oaths. Well, there's one example. Let's look at another one. Same context here in Matthew chapter 5, same general area as this statement in verse 39. Here in verse 42, Jesus says, give to him who asks you. And from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Now, are we to understand that in an absolute sense? If someone asks for something that you have, if this is to be understood absolute, then you need to give it to them. No questions asked. If there are no limitations here, just out of curiosity, how many of you believe that? How many of you believe that? I was hoping somebody would, because I was coming to your house later tonight. I was going to be the asker. Because if you believe you're obligated to give it to me no matter what, without any limitations, I might find something among your stuff that I like. And I'll come to your house and I'll remind you that that's your obligation from Matthew 5 and verse 42. Now, I don't believe that's what Jesus is saying here. I believe it is qualified. And let me suggest why I think that's the case. We could look at a number of Proverbs, but I think Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 26 will work. The writer says, do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debts. Do you understand what that proverb's about? Tyler, can I use you as an illustration here? I'm going to anyway. I just wanted you to assent. Tyler and Alicia may decide at some point they want to go buy a house. And the bank says, we'll be glad to loan you the money, but we need someone to come in and sign for you to pledge that if you don't make the payments, that person will make the payments. Now, if I'm your choice, you're in a world of hurt. But the point is, Tyler comes to me and he says, listen, I'm asking you to put your stuff, all of your possessions, all of your money, your wealth, whatever you have, I want you to put it at risk so that Alicia and I can buy a house. It's a very nice house. 5-bedroom, you know, big pool in the back, all that sort of thing. Can I tell him no? What did it say? Give to him who asks you. Tyler's asking. Don't I have to give it to him if this is an absolute statement? You and I both know it's not. Sorry, Tyler. How about 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10? Do you remember the context there? There were some problems at Thessalonica. Some of the Christians were apparently of the opinion that the Lord was going to come pretty quick. Paul addresses that both in the first letter and again in the second letter in chapter 2. He says there's some things that are going to have to happen before the coming of the Lord. But in chapter 3, he talks about some of these Christians who, because they thought the Lord was coming pretty shortly, they just stopped working. They were becoming busybodies. They were meddling in other people's business. And Paul says, if you find members, if there are members there who are walking disorderly in this way, then you need to withdraw yourselves from them. They need to be ashamed of their conduct. But Paul also makes the observation. He said, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Now, I want to know how we would follow that admonition, that command. It's a command. How we would follow that if anyone who asks of us, we have to give to them. How could I say no? Okay, I'm going to leave Tyler alone. Should I use my brother-in-law? Yes, absolutely. Gary. Gary decides he doesn't want to work anymore. He's just going to laze around the house and eat bonbons on the couch and watch the soaps. And he comes to me and he says, listen, Alan, we're brothers in Christ. We're even brothers by family. I need you to give me something to help my family buy. And I'd say, well, I love Vicky, but I'm not giving you anything. Would I be able to follow 2 Thessalonians 3:10? Could I say to him, you know what? You're not willing to work. I'm not going to help you. You shouldn't eat if you're not willing to work. Or do I have to give him because of what Jesus said in Matthew 5 and verse 42? Now, I'm belaboring the point. In fact, I beat this horse bloody. But you understand the point. You can't understand these statements in an absolute sense, or you're going to have problems with other statements in the Scriptures. How would we provide for those of us who are providers for our households, how would we provide for those to whom we have material responsibility? Because I guarantee you, if there are no limitations and you have to give to everyone who asks you, you're going to run out of stuff. Because people will come and ask. Debbie and I have, on more than one occasion, lived in the preacher's house. You know what that is? That's a house that a local congregation has bought, and they let the preacher live in that house. And it's usually next to the building. And so every panhandler who sees the church building and realizes that those two buildings are connected makes their way to the preacher's house and asks. I guarantee you we would have been paupers very quickly if I had followed this statement in an absolute sense, because we got asked all the time. Oh, I wish I could share some of the stories with you. If some of those people would work half as hard at a job as they did inventing these stories, they'd be millionaires. But they were always asking. Always asking. Well, I'm going to not belabor the point anymore. Someone says it's too late already. But let's go on to the third one. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. This, of course, is verse 39, the same verse that we're talking about, just the latter part of the verse. Now, did Jesus intend for us to follow that admonition? Absolutely. Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, Jesus didn't do that. Jesus was struck. You remember when we read John 18, verses 22-23? The officer who thought that Jesus was not speaking properly with proper respect to the high priest, he struck Jesus. And Jesus did not turn the other cheek and say, hit me again. He said, is it right for you to do this? He challenged what that man had done. It was wrong. It was evil. Jesus didn't do this in an absolute sense. I'm going to come back to this idea. Some have suggested that slapping on the right cheek, if you're talking about... I need a volunteer, somebody who can take a pretty good smack. Tim? Yeah. I'll tell you what, I'll just describe it for you so that you can understand. I'm left-handed, but most people are right-handed. Most normal people are right-handed, and so if you are going to use your right hand to slap somebody and that person's facing you, if I slap this way, which cheek am I of the face am I going to hit? It's going to be the left cheek, right? Isn't it interesting that Jesus says, whoever slaps you on the right cheek. Now, if I'm right-handed, how would I hit you if you're facing me on your right cheek? Well, I could go like this and do some sort of MMA move. Or I could take the back of my hand and smack you on your right cheek, which is typically not a blow for doing damage. It's a way of indicating insult. And that's true not just in our culture. I saw several sources that said that was true in Jewish culture also. I believe that what Jesus is talking about here is an insult. And what he's saying is, if somebody insults you, even using this explanation of the backhanded blow to the cheek, you need to be willing to take that, to accept that wrong. I really do believe that's what Jesus is saying here. I think the Jewish rabbis were misusing the provision of the Mosaic law that was cited back in verse 38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now go back to chapter 21 of Ezekiel, to Exodus in verse 24. And what you'll find is that law was designed to make sure that the punishment for some injury done to another was commensurate with the injury that had been committed. If I knocked out Tim's tooth, then I would lose a tooth. Sometimes when you start talking about vengeance or retaliation, particularly personal vengeance or retaliation, sometimes people want to up the ante a little bit. Israel says that nowadays with respect to the Arabs. You know, you black our eyes, we'll black both our eye, we'll black both of your eyes. The idea is I'll do you more than you did to me. This law was designed so that justice was fairly administered as opposed to being just a matter of personal vengeance. But the rabbis, I believe, had corrupted that so that what they were doing is they were saying, listen, you have the right to respond in the same measure as what was done to you. And so rather than be a limitation of abuse, it became permission to return evil for evil. You hit me, I'll hit you back. But I got to hit you the same amount. You know how they used to do in the arms when we were kids? You hit me twice in the arm, I hit you twice in the arm. That was the idea that they were using. They'd abused the law. Jesus says, instead of you being anxious to even things out and demand your rights and to take advantage, to return evil for evil, you need to be willing to accept wrong. And frankly, I think there are times when Christians need to do that. I think there are times when the gospel is promoted by that very thing. I think that's really what Jesus is getting at in this particular section from verse 38 and for really all the way down to verse 48, which is why I asked Tim to read the entire statement. I think these statements, these that are on the screen here, they need to be understood in the light of their context and in harmony with other passages. Someone says, is he ever going to give an answer to this question? Fear not. Here's my answer. I believe that Jesus' point in Matthew 5, 38 to 48, is that disciples need to be willing to suffer wrong. That's what I just stated. They should not pursue private retaliation. We don't resist evil with evil. We don't do the tooth for a tooth, eye for an eye thing. But that doesn't preclude protecting ourselves or others from violence. And I believe there are times when a Christian might need, because I agree with Martin Luther, I believe there are times when if we're suffering as a Christian for our faith, we need to just endure that. There'll be times when people take advantage of us. They'll do it in business dealings. And incidentally, the contractor I talked about earlier, he didn't take a Christian, the fellow Christian, to court. He ate the damages. That cost him big time financially. But he was willing to suffer wrong rather than retaliate, in that case, take a member of the Lord's church to law. Guess what? We're not getting to that question tonight. There may be times when the cause of Christ may be better served by accepting hurt or harm from unbelievers. And I got to tell you, I'm a little guy. Some of you may have noticed that. Some of you have poked fun at me as you look down on me. And you know something about little guys? Little guys sometimes grow up with chips on their shoulders. They've got to make sure that nobody pushes them around for fear that everyone will push them around. And if you're not careful, you can develop the attitude of, I don't take anything from anybody. And frankly, I think that's absolutely contrary to the spirit of the disciple that Jesus is talking about here. Do I believe that a Christian can defend himself in his own home against a violent aggressor? Yes, I do. Can he defend his family? Yes, I do. Could you defend somebody else who was being attacked in an alley and you happen to see what was going on? I believe you can do that. I think you ought to do good. I think you ought to help others as you best can. And that person is committing evil. You're not retaliating against evil with evil. You are doing good to save somebody else. I think you have a right to do that, maybe even a responsibility to do that. But in our desire to understand what Jesus is not saying, let's not miss what he is saying. And that is that Christians are sometimes going to have to accept wrong. Even sometimes, if we were to get to the second question, we find out even sometimes from other Christians. Certainly it's going to happen from unbelievers. There'll be people who mouth off at you. There'll be people who cut you off in traffic. How do you respond? I'll tell you, I haven't always responded very well. I had to work at that. Can I tell you a funny story? The moral of this story is, parents, you need to be really careful about what you say in front of your kids. We lived in West Groves, and the boys were young. They'd sit in the back seat. They were old enough that they could sit on the seat. And somebody would cut us off or do something really stupid on the road, and I would say, man, where's the 357 when you need it? And I was just, it was my way of trying to avoid just venting anger and everything. Where's the 357 when you need it? Well, one day we're all in the car and we're driving along, and somebody did something. I said, I can't believe it. That guy. And one of the boys, I don't remember which one, said, Dad, do you need the 357? Now, to calm you, I didn't have a 357, either in the car or in my home, but it hit me like a ton of bricks what I'd taught my sons. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. How do you respond when something like that happens? Can you look at it and say it's a trivial matter in the big picture? That's a tough thing to do sometimes, especially if you're a little guy with a chip on your shoulder. Well, I appreciate your attention. How many of you want to go for the second question? Nearly the same number of people who wanted to give all their stuff to me. I apologize for not moving through this any faster, but hopefully you found some things or heard some things in our study this evening that have encouraged you or helped you understand a little bit better God's will. I want to finish this evening by extending the invitation. I want to say this about these questions. I regret we didn't get to the second question, but I think the first question is an extremely practical question. It's a question that if you don't agree with the answer that I've given, that's okay, but you need to wrestle with the text. You need to understand, try to understand what Jesus is saying and what our responsibilities are. Because this isn't, I've used a little bit of humor this evening, but this isn't a funny joke thing. People are going to be lost because of this sort of thing. People who take advantage of their brethren are going to be lost because of this very thing. Brethren who will not accept wrong from anybody are going to be lost because of this very problem. It's important that we understand what the disciples, what the citizens of the kingdom, what their character is and how they behave in practical situations in life. Are you a citizen of the kingdom? Have you submitted yourself to the King, to Christ, the Lord? That's what obeying the gospel is all about. Once we understand that He's the only way to the Father, that He's the only way who can provide salvation through the grace that is found in His blood, then we need to acknowledge that need, confessing our faith in Jesus Christ, having repented of our sins, and we need to be baptized. We need to be born again of water and the Spirit, as Paul describes it in Romans 6 and Jesus describes it in John 3, so that we can be born into the spiritual family of God, be citizens of the kingdom, because we have a hope, citizens of the kingdom do, that we'll be able to spend eternity with God. Is that your hope? If not, then you need to respond to the gospel this evening if you have the faith that the Scriptures require, and we invite you as we stand and sing.